Welcome to Trauma from the Frontline. My name is Bruce Perham. I'm a counsellor who has provided counselling and training to correction officers and frontline responders for over 15 years. In this series, I will be interviewing a wide range of psychologists who work in the trauma field, key stakeholders in the emergency sector, and frontline workers who have experienced mental health and at times trauma reactions due to the field in which they work. Welcome to Trauma from the Frontline. Today, my guest is Tim Peck, and Tim was a police officer for 21 years. I'll get Tim to fill us in on what his current role is, and then we'll get into the interview. Thanks, Tim. Welcome.
Wonderful. Thanks, Bruce, for the welcome. Yes, Tim Peck, my current role, I'm the Deputy Director of a project called Responder Assist with Phoenix Australia. Phoenix Australia are affiliated with Melbourne University. They are the leaders in post-traumatic health. And the role of Deputy Director relates to what was called the Centre of Excellence for Mental Health for Emergency Workers, a state government-funded project that we're bringing together at the moment and is going well.
Wow. So you don't sit in the office with your feet up and thinking, what will I do next? It sounds like that's pretty full-on.
It's a good role, yeah. It takes a bit of maintaining my own and keeping a very close eye on my own mental health as I manage my role, but a really rewarding and challenging role, which is great.
Wow. We might wind the clock back a little bit, back when you were a younger man and you started to think, I think I might be a policeman. Can you take us back to that time and what your thoughts were and how your training started and just how were things at the beginning?
Yeah, it was a bit of a spur of the moment decision. I was 24, grew up in the country, played a lot of sport, enjoyed family, enjoyed friends, was in Melbourne working at a factory, at a steel factory, in fact, with a friend there, and he decided he was going to join Victoria Police. And I'd never thought of it. Hadn't been a burning desire. I'd only been in Melbourne for about 12 months, and I followed his lead and put the application in and joined. So I had no other family, no other history of anyone in the family being involved in policing. But for me, it was a career I thought I could have a go at. And quite ironically, as soon as I got in, I joined in May of 1994, went through the academy and hadn't been out long. And my goal quite clearly from the outset was to become a detective. That was the be all and end all for me from the time I joined. Not premeditated, but that's just how it turned out.
So what appealed to you about from the beginning? Does that come through in the training or that's what I wanted to be?
I think it might have been my first station was Russell Street, which was the old Russell Street complex. Yeah. It shut down not long after I arrived there and they moved to the new building. But I think my first experiences with like major crime scenes and so on and the detectives and the work that they did, it was something that appealed to me. And there was a couple of mentors there that I got to know early on who really pushed me in that direction, but something that I always found a strong interest in much more than some of the other aspects of policing.
Right, so it was sort of almost like a natural fit because often, when I talk to police officers, I say it took them a while to work out quite where they wanted to go and even well into their careers. So I don't know whether to go senior sergeant, don't know whether to go, but for you it was detective.
Yeah, so even, I think I was in uniform for 6 or 7 years on the van and doing special duties and so on, but even through that period, my focus was on crime. I was never big on the traffic side of policing or other aspects. It was crime investigation was really my burning desire at that stage.
Yeah. Right. So how were those early years? I mean, in a way, like a lot of people, you've gone into that as a career, not really, not having any family around you, no one that you've seen their careers, so it would have been a bit of a jump into the unknown. How did you find those early years when, you're through the training and you're out on the street?
Yeah, look, I loved it, to be honest. The early years were great. It was, in many ways, I'd played a lot of footy and stuff, and it was an extension of a footy club.
Right.
It was a really great camaraderie. We did some really good work, really enjoyed the company of others, the shift work and so on. I enjoyed being at work. It was I thought I'd found my feet. That was something I was good at. I was getting good results. Family life was a little bit more challenging because of the shift work, and we had some children along the way then, so that was a little more complex, but certainly the work side of it, I really found my feet pretty quickly, I'd say.
How did you deal with, in the early days, the situations that you would go to? And I know police work is very diverse in terms of the sorts of situations that you would have found yourself in. You know, how did you start to process that side of the work, you know, whether it be road accidents or whether it be suicides or whatever? How did you go with that in the beginning?
Yeah, I think from the outset, on reflection, I think my sort of coping strategy or defence mechanism was I really looked at everything as an investigation.
Right.
So no matter how difficult or challenging or graphic a crime scene may have been, I think my distraction was, well, what can I take out of this to help with the investigation?
Right.
Or what can I use out of this that I might be able to, you know, further the investigation or help me with a witness statement down the track or whatever the case may be. So it was sort of like putting the graphic detail to one side and really concentrating on my role and what I needed to do as really a distraction on reflection, I think. But that's certainly what I did.
At the time, was that generally what people did, you know, that you would focus on your role, that, you know, I have a role to play and I have things I need to do. Was that sort of what you just learnt? That's how I handle these sort of situations?
Yeah, I think, on reflection, I thought everybody did that. And, you know, we'd go and have a beer afterwards or, you know, have a chat about it afterwards. There was never any issue with, you know, people being around you. What I probably didn't realise is how affected other people might have been by that trauma, and I didn't pick up on it because I was so focused on what I was doing and probably didn't have the education and training at that stage to look at it in that way, and I was a junior member looking up at others. So to me, they always coped. I look back now and many of them weren't, but there was a real culture, I think, of, you know, really keeping that internal. Mm-hmm. You don't disclose you have a mental health condition. You don't want to show any weakness. You just soldier on. So, you know, we'd go out and, you know, have a few beers, whatever the case may be. Very rarely did you see anyone really have any emotional reaction or, and when we talked about it, we didn't talk about how we were feeling. We'd talk about the incident.
Look, as a counsellor, I can really connect with that in almost that what you're seeing, it's almost too hard to put into words. I mean, what you're seeing visually, so that temptation or of that bottling it up. I mean, I might be feeling a reaction here, but the beers or the, you know, I just kind of, I need to roll on and keep focused on what I'm doing.
I think there's another aspect to it too, in that, you know, we of all the hundreds of thousands of words that I wrote whilst I was a member of Victoria Police. So whether that be statements about scenes that I'd visited or affidavits about obtaining search warrants or whatever the case may be, summaries for offences. Never once did you write about emotion. In fact, we were taught not to write about emotion. So we had to be really sure that our diaries that we kept had no reflection about our own personal reaction to that incident. So in some ways, I think you become really skilled at just taking the bits out that you're going to have to use, the bits that you need to remember because that may be an issue at court or it may be an issue for a witness statement. So, again, that sort of splitting of pushing away the trauma and the confrontational aspects of an incident and focusing on the things you can control became my go-to strategy. Now, I can't say whether others used that same strategy the whole time, but what I can say is that many others didn't express themselves in any way around the situations we're exposed to.
I suspect the majority of you were dealing with it in that way. Yeah. So you mentioned that when you look back and you see now that maybe some of the officers back then weren't managing. No, it's not managing, it's we're reacting to. I often feel that, you know, it gets called mental health, but it's really reacting to what you're experiencing and what you're seeing. What can you remember now looking back and thinking, well, maybe that officer wasn't travelling so well?
I think there's, you know, without going to specifics, but things like you could tell when people were affected by poor sleep. Like our shift work was pretty ordinary, and then if we did long shifts or overtime and you'd be back the next morning with 2 or 3 hours sleep, alcohol intake was a real trigger that we really didn't monitor but was clearly there. But things like workplace conflict, you know, silly arguments over pretty much nothing. Really rallying against anything that command or management come up with was wrong because we were out in the field and we knew what was right. So there was always this conflict, and I think that was a bit of a probably a sign that people weren't coping as well as they might. And one of the ways that they cope with that or manage that is to come together and pretty much like change management in that organisation would be so difficult because at every level there's someone with another way of trying to say it doesn't work. So I think, you know, the really basics of, you know, diet and sleep and exercise and things all drop away, and you can see, and then you'll see it in their personal relationships, so marriage breakdowns, issues with children, things like that. So in hindsight, it was there, but certainly, particularly when I was junior, you didn't feel you were in a position that you would have a conversation with a senior member about their mental health. That certainly wouldn't have happened. And even when I was in as a senior member, I wouldn't have had a conversation with a junior member either. So
we'll talk about that a bit further on because, I mean, what I really connect with what you're saying in terms of it's what's happening around you as well. And, you know, I know cultures are more aware of that now, but it would have been in lots of ways from an emotional point of view quite a lonely place for most of the officers because you would have, you know, gone home and had, you know, the visions or whatever of what you've seen, and, you know, these reminders that our brain is pretty clever at throwing back at us, but then having to negate that. Was it a lonely sort of like, it's all on the one hand you're saying, well, I'm okay, but on the other you're experiencing stuff that a lot of people don't ever experience, don't ever see, you know. Was it a bit of a battle to kind of put that together?
Certainly not in the early years.
No.
So my focus on work was so intense.
Right, and your career.
And my career, yeah. And, you know, it was like the busier I was, the better I was at managing.
Right.
So I would throw myself into work and then family life would fit in around that if it could. But work was a priority, make no mistake, in regret in a lot of occasions, but I'll come to that later on.
Yes.
But I think that whole notion, and it was a culture that really supported that it, you know, if you worked hard and got good results, you'd be rewarded. So if that was a way of managing my mental health and getting through, quite not a conscious decision, but subconsciously that was what I did. It helped me in good stead for a long time.
Mm. And you mentioned a bit before that there wasn't, or there didn't seem to be the awareness around the work-life balance, which everyone talks about now. You've got to have work-life balance and you've got to do those sorts of things. You know, back then, was there just, it was about your career, it was about advancing, it was about, you know, and I get that, you know, in doing your job, you don't put emotion in your job, don't put personal reaction. So the whole system really was sort of about that, not about, well, are you looking after yourself? Is that?
Yeah, I think I was probably a bit one out of the box around that. Like, I was so determined to get where I wanted to get to that I would take on extra work at any stage,
right,
just to try and show that I was, you know, the next big thing, so to speak. Yeah. So for me, and it became a bit of a circular trap in a way, because my reputation became so important that I would continually do things to try and enhance that reputation.
Another looking back question, you know, what would you attribute to that driving force in you? You know, what was driving you at that point to be so focused on,
I think it's
on the career?
It's not a simple answer, that one. I think, and part of my conflict became later on, was that in my view, if I'm doing my job well, I'm helping the community and yes. I'm helping those victims and, you know, witnesses and so on in really difficult circumstances. I knew I was good at what I did, so I could have a really significant impact on that. And I was a fairly good educator of other staff,
yes.
So in a technical sense, not in how to look after yourself sense, yes. But in a technical sense, I had a strong knowledge of what was required in that investigative field. So I think that part of it kept me going a lot of the way. The other part of it really was what became problematic for me later on, was that as I continued to grow this persona, if you like, something else had to suffer. And unfortunately for me, that was my family.
Mm.
In that, you know, I often use the analogy that, you know, if I was to write down the four most important things in my life back then, I guarantee you I would have said my wife, my children, my physical health, and my mental health, yet I wouldn't have made one decision any day where they come first. Mm-hmm. Work always come first. and then I would try and pick up the pieces of what was left.
What were they saying to you? What was your family saying to you at that time?
Look, it was a combination. It was a look, my wife, you know, is a nurse, so she has some understanding. Mm. She was really on to me about, you know, sleep and diet and keeping exercising, and wasn't as if everything was, every day was bad. It's like mental health, it goes up and down. And there were occasions, you know, and also I think life stage has a lot to play with it as well. Like when you're doing some of those really big investigations, and it does become all-encompassing because you need to do that to get the result. But there's a sacrifice that's going to go with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think my battle was that I didn't stop at the end of an investigation and take stock and say, well, hang on, that took a bit out of me. I need to take a break or do some different work for a while. I'd just jump straight into the next one. What's the next big one I can do? So that created this environment where, you know, the family are saying, well, you've got to pull up at some stage. This is going to end badly. Me continually saying, after the next one. After the next one, I'll pull up. So I had an awareness.
Mm-hmm. So you heard them.
I heard them.
But it was too hard
to
let go of that.
Yeah.
I guess in all first responder work, you know, it comes from that helping the community as a simple, you know, of nurses or police or correctional, anybody, you know, they do that to provide that sort of help, and that's the driving force as to, you know, which you put beautifully. Does that sort of then blind you to your own health? Does that, because the purpose is so good, it's so, you know, people need that and they need the support and they need police and detectives to solve crimes. And you see it on the news all the time, you know, if only there could be some closure, if only we could, you know where the body was, all right? If only we could have the person caught and convicted. Does that sort of blind you a bit to, while your family's saying, well, hang on, Tim, you really got to look after yourself a bit here, but the importance of what you're doing was just too big?
I love the phrase that you use, blind, because the word that I use is I made my mental health invisible.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did everything I could, went to extraordinary lengths to make sure that nobody knew about what was going on internally for me, and I would do whatever I could to stop the anxiety or the flashbacks or whatever it was that was coming my way. So I think that notion of helping others, that was probably my biggest conflict. The person I wanted to be, the family man, the good dad, the good brother, husband, son, was clearly being impacted by my desire to be the absolute best in the workplace. How do you reconcile that? That probably became ultimately my biggest challenge, in that I couldn't reconcile that. I couldn't find a way that I could let go of that reputation and the good work I was doing on one side, and continually reminding myself that you're doing great work for the community. This is, you know, this is a important job that you're doing, but not realising that I'm no good to anyone if I'm not working or functioning well.
I've had the odd person describe it as almost an addiction, you know, that you become addicted to I've had a lot of people reflect it in different ways, that yes, it's demanding, or like when correction officers talk about codes, or when police talk about, you know, going into those really highly volatile situations, and they'll sort of say, I know that it's taking a lot out of me, but it's sort of almost, you know, I get addicted to the buzz, and when I don't have it, it's almost like I don't want to be hypervigilant, but when I'm not high, I don't know, you know, is it that type of I should let it go, or I should back off a bit, but I don't want to back off a bit, or?
Yeah, my experience was different to that. Most of my career was in investigations, crime investigations, yes. and serious, like high-end crime investigations. So for me, it became more of a challenge around how can I use the skills that I have
to
outsmart somebody else.
Get an end result. So it's a bit of an intellectual challenge in that.
And in that, I had to learn more about the resources we had, more about how I can use them within the framework of the law, and then be able to prove it at court.
So it's sort of a strategist.
So it became, a really all-encompassing in that way. So, mm-hmm. you know, I spend many, many hours thinking about – I used to have this thing where I'd try and put myself as the target that I was looking at. And live a day in their life in my brain about what would they do today. And I'd spend hours trying to figure out what were they doing, how would they be thinking, and the other part of me thinking, well, how can I take advantage of that? If I get that right, how can I take advantage of what what their life is. So the more I can immerse myself in somebody's whole life, the more I'd be able to predict what decisions they'd make or what conversations they may have, which would open up windows as an investigator to capture information or evidence. So it became quite the all-encompassing.
I can see how it could become that because of the complexity of it. And so when did you first start to recognise that or start to feel the anxiety or that, well, you know, I've spent years telling myself I'm okay. When did you first start to think, I don't know that I am feeling okay?
So there's probably a couple of points. It took me about 7 years to get my first detective spot, and that was a continual work in progress. Like you always had to be at the top of the list as how many briefs you had and trying to improve your reputation and so on. I then landed a spot out at, out at Mill Park, out at the a detective's team out there, suburban area. Really, really busy, was a new kid on the block, so again, had to prove myself to be the best, and then went into the missing persons unit at the homicide squad, where I stayed for a number of years. But I guess the first one, I did get done for drink driving on the way home from work after we'd done a search warrant out at Mill Park, and I only went over, I was 0.06 something, so in those days you got 10 demerit points and a fine. And you know, what was stark now as I look back was that it wasn't seen as somebody who might be, you know, struggling with their workload or because I was performing to a really high level. Mm-hmm. It was more just, yeah, that's just a mistake. You'll be right. Push on. And there was really no sanction for it at all other than I, you know, obviously I had to wear the demerit points and the fine.
A bit of a wrap over the knuckles. But
It wasn't even that. It was it was really, you're a good detective and we want you and keep working and, it was a blip, but you'll be okay. So, but internally, I think for the first time, I thought, well, that's a really poor decision. And, you know, my alcohol intake was a problem at that stage. But then I went into town into missing persons and homicide, and I was actually reduced my alcohol intake because I was so conscious of other people finding out that I was drinking too much or that I had any mental health issues. Certainly not being open with myself about that. And once I got in there, that the workload and the work was so interesting and there was so much work to do. I just lost myself in that world for a period of time. And, you know, a number of fairly high-profile homicide investigations that I did, really, you know, I love the work. I would say now if I went back and did it again, it was fantastic. It was some of the best work, I think, that I did. But it was having a toll, and it probably wasn't until about 2008 or 9, I think. So I'd been a detective for some time by then, and at homicide, there was a task force set up out in the northern suburbs, and it was to investigate a number of unsolved non-fatal shootings in the Middle Eastern organised crime area. And what they decided at command was to take a member from each of the crews at homicide to go and start this new task force, along with some from armed crime and other areas of the workforce. Now, it was absolutely in our crew, we would take it in turns when these things come up and someone would have to go. It was absolutely my turn. Don't make no mistake. But I think on this occasion, and you know, I've spoken to my boss about this, who was my boss at the time, in hindsight, and he basically just said, yeah, it's your turn, Tim, you've got to go. And you know, I didn't accept it well. I was a bit of a pain in the ass, I'd say, at that stage of my career. I was fairly full of myself. But in hindsight, I think what he wanted to say was that you're overweight, you look tired all the time, your work performance isn't once what it was, you appear to be struggling. Let's have a bit of a break. You can go over there and do some different work and see how you go. That conversation didn't happen. The conversation was simply, it's your turn, you have to go. So for me, that was a real kick in the guts. It was like, after all that I've put in, after all that I've done, I'm just being shafted over here.
Would you have liked that conversation at that time? Would that have...
I would have went off. I would have been terrible. I would have reacted really
badly.
Absolutely would have reacted badly. So that was our culture. I'm certainly not having a dig at the boss who we had the conversation with. That's how we did business. That was how it happened. So I'm trying to highlight that back then, those conversations, even though we probably recognised it, we didn't talk about it.
Yeah. So is that with that sense of that your career was slipping, that you worked so hard to get to that point?
No, I would say that was more of my ego.
Yeah, the ego.
I'm a homicide. I'm a homicide detective. I don't do that other work.
Yeah,
but that was in hindsight.
You weren't Right, okay. So you leave me where I'm.
Good.
Good.
Yeah.
Don't move me.
Yeah.
Just before I forget, you know, what role back then was the alcohol playing? You know, what was the alcohol, because it comes up all the time when you run training, or what was the alcohol doing for you at that point?
So by 2009, so I'd been at homicide for a period of time and my alcohol intake had increased significantly again.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much every day, and mainly to manage my anxiety.
Yes.
Mainly to my insecurities or that someone would find out, and it became a really internal battle around this.
Well, the risks are high.
You're doing great work, but if someone finds out that you're struggling with your mental health or that you're drinking too much, you're going to get caught out, and then they're not going to let you work, or they're going to shift you, and you won't be allowed to do the work you want to do. So that was not only creating issues internally and at the workplace, but also at home, obviously, because my alcohol intake was problematic for the family.
Were you defensive about that when if your partner or your wife or your kids were saying, "Well, Dad, you're drinking a lot," you know, were you defensive to that, or did you sort of?
I knew. Yeah. I think I had a fair idea that I was struggling with alcoholism at that stage. I actually went and saw a psychologist during that period. And I remember I had six sessions with him, and I still see his name in some of the work I was doing, particularly a couple of years ago. A really good qualified psychologist. I spent six sessions with him, and I remember walking out after six sessions, and he said, "I don't need to see you again now. I think there's no more work that we can do that's going to be of any benefit." And that was primarily because I'd gone there and given him nothing and lied my whole way through the six sessions, and he was clearly on to me that.
Right.
I'd love to see his notes. I'm pretty sure he just would have written that this guy would be back. But for me, that was just a way of pacifying my wife and saying,
"Yeah, look, I'm getting the help I need.
I've got the help I need." Yeah. And he says I'm okay. And I think I even said he said I can keep drinking, which I'm sure he didn't. But
I'm sure he didn't.
So that was sort of the mindset I was in. I was, absolutely hanging on to try and keep going and keep my issues invisible. I didn't want anyone to know.
With the early anxiety that you mentioned, did you have any idea then of what the anxiety was, what it was representing, what a lot of people say to me, you know, what the F is this shit? You know, they have no idea of why they might be shaking before they go into work. Or did you have any idea of what was happening? You know, why am I getting this anxiety? Or
No, so for me, I used to use the analogy of I'll just gulp it down. I'll toughen up, I'll gulp it down. I'll either get on the drink or I'll find a way.
Yes.
And I'll get back into it.
To suppress it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I knew it didn't feel great and I didn't like the way it made me feel. So I would either throw myself back into work or get on the drink or do whatever I could to ease my mind from dealing with what was going on.
That couldn't have been a great space.
It was a terrible space. Yeah.
So what happened then, you know? So, you know, the awareness is starting to come. I'm not in good shape here. What then continued on from that point?
I'm going to use my favourite analogy here, but Big Paul probably don't like it too much. So I got promoted. That's what we do when people aren't going as well as they could.
Don't let me get into that. But So
it was quite ironic. So 2009, I was a detective senior constable. I got selected for a sergeant's position in uniform out at Moonee Ponds. I lasted there for about 12 weeks before I moved over into just to give you some understanding, homicide detectives and, you know, the gun detectives, we don't wear uniforms. That's not part of our go.
Yes.
So going back to uniform for me, even though it's a promotion, is like a step back.
Right, okay.
That's not in my...
So you'd moved on from that, yeah.
So I went to that and then I was heavily involved in what's called human source management or informer management and done a lot of training around that. And I landed a role out at Faulkner as the human source liaison officer, I think it was called, for 12 months, mainly so I could be out of uniform. But one of the side effects was that I really didn't have any management. I was a sergeant, didn't have any management around me. I'd use others to help me with my role. Had a lot of freedom about what I did and I was good at it. I was able to get information and continually have intelligence coming in. But it really fed my alcoholism in that I could hide it really effectively and no one would know. I could work odd hours. I could work when I wanted to, still getting the work done, but I could really do that without that real worry that anyone was going to find out. So it let me drift off into this sort of world of just continuing the fantasy. Look how good you are. You're getting results and you can be a fully functioning alcoholic.
Yes, you can do both.
There's a way through this. And ironically, the year after, I got promoted to a detective sergeant's role at Heidelberg or Banyul CI. Again, managing people. Again, when I got there, I got off the drink. This will be the new start that I need. Change of work location. I'm now a detective sergeant, so I've got more responsibility. I'll have to, you know, really knuckle down. I think, unfortunately, all I achieved was, well, look, my skill set was good in that, and I was a good educator. So I did bring a lot of people along, but only if they wanted to be part of my group. So culturally, I'd say I was a really poor manager.
Right.
In that if you weren't as smart as me or you couldn't work as fast as me or willing to do the hours that I did, you'd quickly be cast aside and I'd find someone who could. So if you're in my group, fantastic, you're the best service ever. If you weren't quite up to that or you weren't willing to sacrifice your home life to the extent that I did, you weren't one of us. So culturally, and then alcohol played a massive role in that as well. So basically I just continued the culture that I'd been exposed to into a new work environment, which in hindsight is probably one of my greatest regrets. I stayed there for about 18 months, so we're up to about 2013 now, and I got approached for a role, and I applied for a role as a detective senior sergeant at the human source unit back in town. So that was a skip of a rank, so I missed senior sergeant, went straight to detective senior sergeant. So in effect, I'd had 4 promotions in 3.5 years, which is nearly unheard of.
So what was that? Obviously, you were good at what you do, despite what's happening in your private life. You clearly were good at what you do. Was that just recognition of that? Even though in some ways you're saying I was at my worst point, but I keep getting these promotions. Was that because you were better than a lot of the other officers, so you were the logical person to be promoted, but nobody picked up on your mental health issues?
I was very, very good at hiding my condition.
So your seniors at the time would have said, oh, Tim's
he's great.
Good to go.
And I was functioning at, that was one of my anxieties, was that, hang on, this, someone's going to work out that I'm not who I'm saying I am.
Someone's going to see I'm a fraud.
Someone's going to work out that he's not doing this, persona that he
portrays.
Because
that's an anxiety in itself, isn't
it?
That fear of, someone's going to catch me out. Someone's going to find out.
And look, it was my decision. I keep applying for the positions.
Yes.
I didn't have to apply and I could have taken a step back and spent more time with the family and probably done the work fairly comfortably and had a good work life.
So is it trying to keep the ego intact? Or is it trying to satisfy that I'm on the rise?
I want to be the best.
So it's almost that dilemma of I'm spiraling downwards personally, but the career's going
the other way,
going up.
And I often reflect that, what sort of message did that send to, the junior members?
Yeah.
If they looked at my work ethic, the amount I drank, the persona that I sort of carried, was that really what we wanted to be, our next generation of leaders to be? Again, it's hard, I'm not being critical because I did, as I said before, I hid my condition really well.
Yeah.
But the work rate and so on that I put into it really wasn't a great example in hindsight.
No, but I'd reflect, though, that, yes, you're hiding it very well, but then it doesn't seem that there was any culture around you that was giving you some guidance in terms of what a good leader is. In terms of good leaders manage their alcoholism, manage their, I don't know. It just didn't seem like you.
There was
a void on the what a good manager is, but you just find yourself in it.
I think I just ignored the bits that I didn't like.
Okay.
If there was certain things that I was meant to do, I'd just ignore them and continue on my own way. And it's a bit like I spoke before about change management. If the changes that come down from above wasn't something I agreed with, I just didn't implement it.
Yes.
So and that's when workplace conflicts and so on really started.
But there were no conversations with you about, you're in a high pressure job now, off the record, Tim, how you're tracking with it, or was there
if those conversations happened,
you resisted them.
I just lied.
I would have said
no, I'm fine, I'm flying.
I'm flying.
Look at my results, I'm going great.
I
really do put a lot of the blame, if you like. It was my own right. view of the world.
So potentially that the assistance would have been there if you'd opened up, or was there a risk that your leaders at that time would have said, oh, hang on a minute, Tim's look, you know, going under here?
I think the stigma around disclosing I had a mental health condition from my experience would certainly have stopped any promotional opportunities that I had. Yeah. That may be wrong.
It's an enormous pressure because your career's going up and the risks go up with it.
and I think the other part was the being operational. I knew that if I couldn't be an operational member, that I couldn't achieve the work that I really enjoyed doing, which was that, you know, investigative work.
Yeah.
I knew if I disclosed what was going on in my head at that time and the level of my drinking, I would never have been allowed to carry a firearm.
No. And that's, the ramifications for your career, I mean, that would be your worst nightmare in a way.
That's the house of cards then.
If it was all to tumble down, yeah. So you keep getting promoted despite yourself.
Yep.
And did the anxiety and all of that just continue to get worse?
By 2014, I was in a real mess. I'd been there about 3 or 4 months. I'd been off the drink again, which was my want, as generally when I change work locations.
So there is awareness of I need to be off this to do this job.
I was actually seeing a trauma and grief counsellor to help me with my alcoholism.
Right.
Wasn't opening up to him either, telling him what I thought. I was playing source management games with him pretty much most of the time.
Yes.
I'd go into the session and see how long I could stay quiet for and test out his silence skills just to be painful. But he was a great fella and still speak to him today.
Yes.
But I think getting back to how I was travelling, so by about March 2014, it's the first time I can put my finger on it, that I was full on back on the drink, really frustrated that, you know, intelligent, articulate, high achieving, but couldn't stop drinking, kept getting back on. The binges were becoming much worse.
Right.
The time and effort and energy to hide my condition was just ridiculous. The lengths I was going to try and hide my condition. Mm. I'd often throw up on the way to work, not because I was hungover, but because I was so anxious about going to work. The intrusive thoughts and the nightmares, I reckon my sleep was probably 2 hours a night at that stage.
Right, okay.
So to cope, I would, if I woke at 4, I'd get up and go to the gym, even though I was still hungover and whatever else, but just to get moving or do something until I could get through to the end of the day and have a drink.
So were you having the in the dreams or nightmares or flashbacks? What was happening in your sleep?
Well, I didn't sleep.
Right.
I just that usually was what woke me up.
Right. So that we don't need to go into it, but that's like memories from the past.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep. And as it went on, more of this, a lot of stuff around the fear of being caught out. This hypervigilance around someone's going to work out that you're a fraud.
Yes.
That was also a really big part. But specific dreams about specific incidents were common. So by about March of that year, for the first time that I really recall thinking about it, and I'm not sure what caused it, but suicide became an option. And I remember first thinking about it and thinking, well, that's just stupid. You know, I've been to enough of those and that's a weak person's way out, and they're weak pricks that do that, and so on and so on. But over the next few months, it's difficult to describe, but thinking about suicide actually became a safe place. That stopped my anxiety or reduced my anxiety. It stopped some of the intrusive thoughts and the flashbacks and so on that I'd have. Obviously, it became higher risk when I was drinking. But I wasn't telling anyone about any of this. It was really just me and my world then. And as I went more into my internal world, I reflect back now and it was like there was two of me. There was a part of me that was this, really driving force around work and so on, and this is the way out. And this other part of me is just trying to escape and get back to who I wanted to be. But I was trapped in this unwinnable situation.
Mm-hmm.
Family life was just holding on. These thoughts of suicide were giving me some comfort.
So that when you thought about ending it, and then you think, well, it's over, that would give you some peace.
Absolutely.
There is an out, even though the other half of you is saying, well, that's not an out that's really fits with you. But I can really get a sense of how it becomes your safe place in a very ironical sort of way. Your safe place is I have an exit because it's all got too much for me. Yeah, so on. So you started to think about that. And would you battle with yourself over that? You know, hang on, Tim, what are you thinking?
At the start, absolutely.
It was a, you know, are you really serious about this?
It was continual back and forth, back and forth. By about August, I remember it was just after my birthday of that year, and I was at with my wife in a park up in near home. I'd had another really bad week on the drink. It was a Saturday. I was in a bad place, and she used to always try and get me walking and keep me moving and so on. I hadn't slept. And she was really trying to get me to take some time off. Like, I had all my long service leave. I had 300-something sick days. I had holidays everywhere, but could not bring myself to take time off because they might find out that I'm not who I say I was.
Yes.
Or they wouldn't cope without me, which was just nonsense. But that was what my brain was talking about. And I remember disclosing to my wife then that I won't be here at Christmas. It's plans are underway. And she asked, what do you mean by that? And I tell her, and of course, where does that leave her? What does she do with that? Like, she can't ring a boss and tell him. She knew I was seeing a counsellor. She knows that if she had said anything, I would have denied it and said it was a throwaway line. Really difficult to go back to family and talk about that. So I was pretty clear by August, 3rd of October, 3 o'clock in the morning, I crashed a covert police vehicle into a parked truck in Grange Road in Fairfield, absolutely hammered when I did it. That was one of my plans about suicide. I'm not sure whether that was the attempt. I'd had a really bad day at work-wise. That wasn't a bad day for anyone else. It was a bad day because of the condition I was in. Something didn't go my way and I reacted really badly to it. I'd been drinking by myself for a number of hours. Crashed the car. Obviously knew that that would be the end of my career. Waited for the police to come only because I couldn't get out of the car. I think I would have taken off if I had have, but couldn't get out of the car. Some members of the public were there. And I remember the police turning up and I treated them appallingly. I knew that if I said no to a breath test, they couldn't arrest me. I'd lose my license for 2 years and so on. But I did tell them I'm going to go and kill myself. I jumped in a taxi, went into Spencer Street. I had no real plan. I jumped on a train and went down to Warrnambool. So I sent off a series of text messages to my bosses and family and said, this is it, you won't find me. Turned the phone off. And I had a really clear plan about how that was going to end in Warrnambool. I got to Warrnambool and off the train, and being the good alcoholic that I was, it was by about 9:30 by then, went into the local pub, banged on the door. He let me in. I said, I need a beer. He didn't know why, but I was saying I need a beer. And for someone who'd spent probably 15 years tracking mobile phones and knew everything about mobile phones back then for that technology, I plugged my phone in because my intention was to, my suicide note was going to be recorded on the phone. So I plugged it in, made sure it had power. And of course, they were tracking my phone. And within about 10 minutes, there was a couple of coppers walked in, one of whom I knew. And it was really bizarre. I remember thinking when he come in that, geez, they start early down here in Warrnambool on the drink. Like, this is a bit odd. I didn't put two and two together that I'd been caught out. So that was a really, really difficult period. For me, the suicidal ideation didn't stop for a number of months.
So what happened then? Were you taken to hospital or...?
Yeah, I was taken for a psychiatric assessment, I think it was. And, yeah, I knew what to say pretty much. I wasn't going to be hospitalised. I made that really clear. That would have... Yeah, so... A colleague or a trusted friend came down and picked me up and brought me back to Melbourne. I had to have my counsellor that I'd been seeing and not engaging with, really. I'd have sessions with him every day that were booked in, so I'd have to front up. So it was like a plan, a suicide plan, to make sure that I was in contact. I wasn't to be alone. I had to be with family and so on for periods. And it was a really difficult time, absolute helplessness in that I knew I'd lost my job. So all of that part was now gone.
Yes.
I was a full alcoholic trying to work out how I was going to manage that. Relationship with my kids and my wife was in tatters. Already before that, this was just the icing on the cake. And I'd lost my whole identity about who I was with no chance of redemption. So that was a really difficult period. And I don't know that VicPol really knew what to do with me either. I think they were really struggling with... And look, my boss has tried to reach out and so on, and many, many friends and colleagues tried to reach out, but I refused all of that. I didn't want to talk to anyone.
Was the refusal Because, you know, as you've described, you sort of had nothing else to lose other than your life in a way. Mm. Everything had fallen down. So it's almost like, to the end, I'm not going to talk about any of this. Was it just hard to express where you were at, or was it just hard to put words to it? Or
look, I think many actually thought I'd just made a mistake and crashed the car.
Yeah.
For me, obviously, I knew it was much deeper than that.
Right.
But it was in those first few days that I actually opened up to my clinician around what was going on.
Like, so then you did go, yeah. Okay, I've actually got to start talking about
it. Yeah, so I opened up and I had all sorts of voices going on in my head around, like, these two personas were driving me nuts. Like, it was it was crazy what was going on in my head at that time. You know, I've named one of them now after an imaginary orange horse I had when I was a kid,
right,
called Murdoch, and that's what I think of him as now. This other part of me that's continually chipping away, telling me I'm not good enough, and this, you know, get on the drink, it'll be all right, and you can manage, you've done it before. All that self talk that goes on and on and on. And, you know, I used to always think I was somewhat special in that, you know, I always had this feeling that I thought more quickly than others, that because my head was always full of new ideas and new ways to do things or new solutions to a difficult investigation. Yes. So that really, I guess, cluttered mind that, but in some way cluttered with clarity. Like, there was a lot of things that I'd process really quickly. And I think one of my strengths in policing was that I could digest a whole lot of intelligence and information and digest it quickly and come out with a solution.
Yes.
So I did have a capacity to do that. Now it was mixed up with all these other voices and, you know, this other persona or part of me that was really confusing to try and understand. So that period after was just, the only word I can use is a roller coaster. It was up and down every day that I'd be, you know, some days I'd think, all right, I'm finished with policing, what's next, what can I do? Other days we'd be like, you know, you might as well end it because you're going nowhere. This is hopeless.
And you mentioned so that you still battled that. Yeah. The answer to this is just to go and actually do it.
Absolutely, and it was amazing. I think that probably went on for at least 6 months. Mm. That constant.
So I'd imagine the people around you were terrified that you would, in actual fact, go and do it.
Yeah, it was really hard. That family life was really difficult. And it was funny. I'd flip from really good days to really bad days, you know, one after the other. Like, there was no sense of consistency in any way, shape, or form.
Or you knowing what the day was going to bring.
And then, you know, you throw in, overlay that, and you go, I knew there was a court case coming up. There was a discipline matter I had to get through. It was like I was suspended from work and suspended with pay and so on, but I was actually suspended in time. I was suspended, nothing could move forward until all that resolved.
Yeah.
And that was a 15-month period before that actually resolved. So even though I pled guilty and, you know, put my hand up for the drink driving and all that sort of stuff and caught me whack, it took until January of 2016 before I was finally left FICPOL. Mm-hmm. And even up to that stage, my mind had shifted to, I thought I could go back. I was trying to stay in the job. That's how important it was to me. And I wanted to go back as a uniformed sergeant in welfare and speak to people about how they could manage their mental health better. That sort of, I'd made a lot of progress with my clinician. I went back and, with his encouragement, I did commenced a master's in counselling and psychotherapy, which I went on to complete. But that sort of became my new passion instead of investigations. It was now, I wanted to understand what happened. How did I go from, you know, high functioning and so on to a anxious, suicidal alcoholic? How did that happen?
Mm.
And nobody pick up on it, let alone
me. Yes, yes.
You know, how does that work? And what could I do to try and help others that go through a similar situation?
So looking back now, what – and with going on and doing that further training and the work that you're doing now, what's that brought to your knowledge base? I mean, when you look back at yourself, what do you think was happening now when you look back?
Oh, look, clearly I had PTSD. That was the first thing. I was a fully functioning alcoholic and really had an amazing capacity, I think, to continue to push through what was some extraordinary circumstances.
Yes.
Like, if you think about the work stress I was under, family stress I was under, the fact that I was still fronting up was in and of itself a bit of a miracle.
Yeah.
As I look back, I think the biggest catalyst for me was after the accident, when it wasn't a conscious decision, it slowly evolved, but I slowly and I'll come back to that word, there was a decision to make my mental health visible. So instead of hiding it, and I haven't had a drink since the day I crashed the car. Mm. So again, that was about putting my hand up and saying, yes, I'm an alcoholic and I can't drink anymore. And I'd done some pre-work with that, and you know, I said before it had some periods where I didn't drink. Mm. So there was some building blocks to work with. But when I started to make my mental health visible, when I started to have the conversations, when I started to explain some of my feelings and why I felt the way I did, and you know, my clinician brought me undone around the suicide in a single phrase, just about. I was explaining to him, you know, I could have been in a car with you, in that taxi, and had a whiteboard, and I would have convinced you that suicide was the way out for me. I've got no doubt. That's how strongly I felt about it. I was really clear in my own mind. And part of that was that my family would be better off, my wife would be better off, my kids would be better off, workplace would be better off, financially they're going to be okay, you know, blah, blah. And he said, that's all well and good. You don't get to make decisions about how other people feel. So before you say your wife's okay, how about you ask her how she feels about that? Ask your kids if they're okay with you doing this. If they come back and say yes, I'm on your side. But he knew that wasn't ever going to happen. No. So it really did get me starting to think about, I need to shift my thinking around, you know, there's ways out of this. And so really when I started to become visible and more open and aware about my mental health, then my condition started to, not quickly,
no,
and not in a nice smooth plane.
No.
There was lots of ups and downs, but it did start to improve.
And as a counsellor, you only ever talk to people who don't succeed or don't do it. You never obviously get to talk to anybody that does do it. But that what you shared, you know, that I'm a burden so that everybody's better off without me, I'll often reflect back, well, you know, if you want to wreck your kids' lives and you want to wreck your partner's life and you want to give them something they'll never get over, well, then, you know, taking your own life is going to do that. And probably that's fairly confrontational to, but, you know, the odds are high or the risks are high, you know, that if you go and take your own life thinking that, well, I've done the best thing by my family, so at the counsellor's really rightly go, well, is it really the best thing for your family? Go and ask them. It's a great response to go, well, hang on a minute. It might be something I want to do because it would end my pain, but it isn't actually going to be the answer for them. Was that sort of, what's the word, that line for you to go, hang on a minute, there's more people involved in my life than me?
Yeah, look, even after that conversation, I was still thinking about it.
Yeah.
Probably not as actively and not as seriously, but Yeah, I think you can't sort of – a lot of people will say – and I've been involved in a lot of police suicides since then, and the common theme is that I never picked it. Other people around them will say I never saw it. But if you think about that, why would I tell anyone? Why would I be overt about what I'm intending to do? Because you know that's going to stop what you're trying to achieve.
Yes, yes.
So I'm not going to tell my counsellor. I'm not going to tell my boss or anyone that I'm suicidal. I'll take action. They have to. So when you're in that phase, like as I said – I doubt there would have been anyone that would have convinced me otherwise in that moment that that was the right thing to do.
Mm.
And that would have given me and my family peace. That was the way I was thinking.
And actually, I was just thinking when you said that, Tim, that you're in an occupation where there is that dramatic ramification. Like as a counsellor, if I was in that same sort of situation, it might be that people might say, well, you really need to take some time off to, you know, sort yourself out, but it isn't necessarily the end of my career, or you know. So I can really that's a massive issue. Is that, well, if it becomes public, I'm done in terms of my career. A question around your thoughts about what you've seen in the work that, you know, those, what comes back in the dreams, what comes back, you know. When you go past a crime scene, you think, well, I remember when, you know, all that stuff that put aside, you know, not really a forum to talk about that at the time. Can you get any sense of, well, what role did the bottling all of those emotional reactions up of you know, having a strategy that would allow you to do that because I focus on what I've got to do? In your PTSD and in that sort of the spiral down, what now would you say that played, that not addressing that at the time, not being in an environment that allowed you to address that at the time?
I think, one of my key difficulties was avoidance. So I would go to extraordinary lengths to avoid feeling that way. and do all sorts of things to avoid having to think about those things. Yeah. So I wouldn't sleep because I could avoid it.
Yeah.
I knew if I didn't sleep.
Right, so if you went to sleep, you'd be having the dreams.
Yeah, so don't sleep. That's a simple. Yeah.
So was there an awareness?
Or only sleep when you have it.
An underneath awareness of if I do actually think about what I'm seeing, that is actually ironically going to undo me. So if I don't think about what I've seen, that's the way to go.
So if I push through, that other part of me saying, you've done this before, keep going, you'll be all right. Look what's happened, you've been promoted.
Yeah.
You've got through this before.
Yeah.
Change work locations, just keep going. And that was really my mantra that, yeah, all right, I feel shit, but I'll get through and I'll keep going. I'll just keep going. And you know, because on the other hand, look what I'm achieving for my family. I'm earning a better income. I'm moving up the ladder, so to speak. But what good to them am I in that state?
Yes.
Virtually zero. So it's that whole, again, I probably don't articulate it clearly, there's two sides of me, this part that really wanted to be me as a husband and a father and so on, and then this other absolutely driven beast, if you know what I mean, to put all that aside and just keep working.
It then sort of means that you've got all of those forces at play, but then there's no actual processing of what you're seeing, which is, you know, I know is horrendous. And I sometimes reflect to people, my God, you know, I can't imagine being in that type of scenario and having to deal with what you all deal with. And I think the psychological jury's probably still out on, well, how do we help people see what they see, and what do we do at the time to help them process what they're seeing? And even if we do that, is it still going to come back and haunt you? You know, what's your thoughts on what could be done that would help? Are you going through the ranks now? What could be done to help them recognise, well, this work is having impact, whether you want to admit it or not, it is. Well,
so I look at it very differently now, and probably differently to even, you know, after I left policing. I worked at Beyond Blue for 12 months in the Police Emergency Services Program. I had 4 years at the Police Association as the wellbeing manager, so dealing with people like me every day and helping them through, you know, that really difficult, from a systems perspective, how do we get you through, and how do we deal with work cover, and how do we deal with, you know, transition out if you have to transition, and pensions and all that type of stuff, along with their hooking them up with psychological help. But I look at it really differently now. I think, and it doesn't always sit well with some, but I appreciate and understand that the organisation has an absolute responsibility to look after their staff. But on the other hand, I walked into a high-risk industry. Absolutely can't be disputed about the highest risk industry for a mental health injury in the state at the moment, I think. I had no appreciation of my mental health. In fact, I actively avoided anything to do with learning about, understanding or comprehending my reactions or mental health. I basically took the ticket that I will keep it invisible, hang on for as long as I can and see how I go. That was my plan. In hindsight, what I'd do, you know, in my brain there's four clear steps that I follow now. One is I need to be visible around my mental health. I need to understand that if I'm going to a high-risk industry, and even the work I do now, that there's a chance that that's going to impact on me and that my mental health does fluctuate from day to day, and I'll move, if we want to use the analogy of the continuum from green to red, I'll be up and down that all the time. So I have to accept there's going to be days where I don't feel great, that there's things that are going to be, you know, traumatic experiences that will come back to me, and that's okay, that's going to happen. But what I do need is a plan to manage that. So the first step is to be visible and aware and accept that your mental health will be impacted. The level to which it impacts really depends on the next three steps. So my second step is that I have to have a plan. I know that if I'm impacted, I know exactly which GP I'm going to go to. I know who my psych is. I have a coach that I speak to regularly. I have my wife and family. I have friends and former colleagues and mentors that I speak to, and they all play different roles. But importantly, they're all aware of their role in my management of my mental health. In some ways that helps them as well, because they actually become conduits into others to assisting because they've had these conversations openly. All this planning needs to take place when we're in the green. There's no point waiting till I'm in crisis and then starting to think, where am I going to go to for help? Which, you know, I'll ring the AAP, that'll help me out. really hard to get good treatment when you're feeling like that. So how do we develop a plan that's going to work for us and really think about, well, if I am impacted, to minimise that impact, I need to know what I'm going to do next. Mm. The third part of it is around what I call understanding when you are impacted, so and then being able to take the action. So it's all good having the plan. How do we know when to use it? And that comes from either internally the work that we do around how we're feeling and how we're going, and even then sometimes you don't pick it up. But having that group around you, as I said, that team of people that have the confidence to call out and say, mate, not going as well as you were. You know, this is a bit different to what you usually do or how you usually are, or you reacted really badly to something you don't react to. It might be little things like that, or you're back on the drink, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. But they're aware of your plan as well. So everyone's on the same page about, all right, so if this has occurred, this is what we do next. And the plan doesn't always mean that I have to go and see a psychologist. The plan might be that you need to get back in the gym, mate. You need to, I'll come with you for the next however long and we'll get you back into that routine and all those little things you do every day to manage your mental health. I know what they are. Let's get back into that. Let's start working on your sleep and so on. Obviously, if you do need clinical support, you know where you're going to get that. And the fourth step is about reflecting and reviewing, because what worked for me at 35, or didn't work for me at 35, but what worked for me at different stages of my life isn't going to work now. So I need to continually adapt and evolve and reflect on how I'm going and continue to learn about mental health, about other aspects of it that might be able to help me look at things differently or manage my condition differently. But also, how can I help others? So I would say now I'm part of many teams of other people who come to me for assistance or advice or guidance around their mental health. So you can create this really nice network of similar-minded people thinking in a similar way where mental health is spoken about openly. And then that cycle continues because we go back around to the visibility again. Mm. And it's an open and honest conversation about how you're going. So if we focus just on the going to the traumatic event and what do we do straight after it, in my view, it's too late already. In my view, we need to already have been aware of what the effects of a traumatic event might be, have the understanding that if I'm impacted, I know exactly where I'm going to go to get that help. And, you know, a lot of the agencies have EAPs and so on available. Check in every 6 months. Check it, or go and see your GP. Just check in with someone and say, this is how I've been travelling, just to give you that constant reminder around, this is where I'm at. But you feel comfortable then. So if you are impacted, making that phone call and saying, oh, guess what? I went to this thing the other day and I'm not feeling great. I need to come and see you. That's much easier than out of the blue, ringing some person and going to see them for the first time. And as you would know, you'll generally find your first 4 to 6 sessions are just around trying to build rapport, get their confidence that you're not going to tell anyone else what's going on, they're not going to lose their job, how to sleep, why they should be practicing, you know, good diet and exercise and all those simple things we can do. I think the onus is on the individual in high-risk organisations to actually be far more proactive around all those things. And then the organisation obviously needs to create the culture where that's okay to talk about that. Mm. And then have the pathways where they can get into care.
Yes, I 100% agree. And I guess the challenge is for corrections, for police. It's often promoted as join us, make a difference, change people's lives. And sometimes I think, but you'll also have a high risk of having PTSD, and you need to have those plans. You need to be aware this is a job that can change you, or this is a job that can expose you to significant trauma. But that seems to be the challenge of how to attract people to these frontline professions. And it's paramedics now, and there's a range that of, you know, they do experience significant trauma, and we're learning, and like what you've been through, we're learning that a possible ramification of that is PTSD down the track. So how do we give people that information that this isn't just something you should do, this is something you must do if when you get to your point you're going to have the strategies to be able to deal with it? Where do we start on
My view is it really is about choices. You know, if you want to do that work, and don't get me wrong, the rewards for that work are magnificent.
They're massive.
You'll never get back some of those feelings you have when you solve a case or you get a conviction or whatever the case may be. It is, you know, a feeling that not many people I'd expect would get. But, you know, you look at paramedics and fireys and so on, corrections, like they do really good work. And it's work that can be enjoyed. My message is that if we take the choice just to let the bucket fill up, you will have heard that a million times, that the bucket fills and then we tip over. My view is that it really is where you are on that continuum when the bucket fills that has the biggest impact. Mm-hmm. So if you're already, like I was, if you're already in the orange or the red most of the time and trauma's continually coming in, it's going to impact you more. So how do we develop a plan that allows us to get back to the green and, and be safe in that? Understanding that if we go there and I'm impacted, I know exactly what to do and what my plan is because the cumulative effect isn't anywhere near as bad when you're getting treatment for each and each incident than if you're remaining invisible and waiting till you've hit the bottom of the barrel like I did and then trying to start a recovery or a you know, rehabilitation back into work. Like you're coming from so far back. My message is we don't need to get that far down the track.
No.
It's a bit like, you know, AFL footy. Great sport, everyone loves it. The risk is you're going to cop a physical injury. It can happen. You know, do your knee, do a shoulder, whatever it is. But that's a risk people are willing to take because they love the game. There's emergency workers that love the job. All I'm asking is they take some of this a view of the world that allows them to prevent that injury. Not saying it won't occur.
No.
But if it does, we'll minimise it.
And it's what you mentioned before. It's almost natural to want to avoid it. It's very difficult to confront trauma. You know, it's just that natural instinct to, well, if I can avoid it, it's a bit like my tooth hurts, but I don't want to go to the dentist. If I can avoid it, there's just a natural temptation to avoid it. Nobody wants to, you know, well, I can't wait to get to see the counsellor to talk about the trauma that I've been through. And I guess it's those smaller steps of, that for people to recognise that it's normal, it's natural, you're going to react to these events, you're not human if you can't. And I guess that's what the aim of doing the podcast is to really, you know, share like your own experience. You've lived it, you know what it's like. Do you feel that and you mentioned before, if you went back to those times when you've been promoted into senior jobs and an officer had come to you and said, Tim, I really need to talk to you about an event I went to yesterday that I'm really, really struggling with. I think you said I would have found it really hard to have that conversation then. How do we help officers? Because I think, you know, in my own view and a lot of what I read is that even though we've got EAP and we've got counsellors and we've got all of that, that if a senior officer can have that conversation, shut the door and go, Tim, I need to hear what you got to tell me and have the capacity to be able to do that. What would you have needed then to be able to have had that conversation? I'm sure you'd have it now all the time, but what do officers need to be able to shut the door and go, you need to tell me about what you're going through?
So the irony is that nearly every manager in VicPol has been a junior member. Well, they all have.
Yeah.
So they absolutely have the experience and the understanding of what occurs. And my message really is that if you want a good workplace and a culture where people are open to talking about mental health, you have to give something of yourself. You need to be part of the conversation, not you tell me what happened to you. And it doesn't mean I want, you know, managers to go there and talk about their most graphic and most horrible things they've been to and they compare stories. That's not what I'm talking about. But having that conversation in a context where you have the understanding of, yeah, I've been through some stuff as well, that there is a way through this. And they're actually the best example because they're still at work and still, you know, they've found a way through. So share some of the strategies that they use. Talk about other members that they're aware of that use different strategies, because we know what works for one won't work for another. But really having that conversation with a focus on the individual who is struggling to think a bit differently about, you know, I hate that phrase that police broke me or I'm broken. Well, there's a lot we can do before we get broken. And that there is an onus. Yeah, the organisation's got to provide a certain, you know, level of cultural respect, I guess, in around the supports they provide. But you're turning up to a high-risk environment. There's a lot of work you've got to do yourself as well. And the trade-off is you get to do the great work and do it well. So for me, it's really more about choice, that if I want to do this job, I've got to invest a little bit more in my own development, my own mental health and understanding of it, and taking the time to tune into my own reactions and when do I feel like I am impacted by trauma and who am I going to talk to if I am. It may be that manager isn't the one you want to talk to. for a whole range of reasons. But gee, have a plan about who you're going to talk to instead of just avoiding it. So, you know, the example I give, you know, I wouldn't tell my wife some of the things that I'd been involved in simply because I don't want her to know that, you know, the graphic detail and so on.
It's too traumatic.
It's too traumatic. So, but there are others I will talk to. Now, that's no disrespect to our relationship or how I get on with my wife. That's just not wanting that particular relationship to have that context. There are others, my counsellor and so on, I can talk quite openly about that and put it into a different way of a different narrative, if you like, that I can go back and explain that. So it's using different parts of our team to explore the different parts of our mental health. It's not just one person that's going to be able to, you know, answer all your questions around mental health. The broader the team, the more people you trust, the more people you share with, the greater chance you have of having a really good plan around managing and continuing to manage your mental health.
That's a really important point in terms of the counselling, in terms of that they are conversations you can have in counselling that might be too traumatic to be having with the people around you. And often, people don't understand what counselling is. I often say people, it's a very low-key conversation. It's, you know, nothing magical, happens necessarily, but I can ask you questions that family members can't. And I can push a bit like when you said your counsellor, okay, Tim, is now the time you're going to let the wall down a little bit? You know, you can ask questions that often other people can't, but you can share the traumas that you're experiencing or that are coming back to you. And there again, there's a lot of psychological debate over critical incident debriefing. Personally, I've never found when you sit a group of people together that have all been at the same trauma that they won't openly talk about it if they have the context to talk about it. Whereas, you know, there's quite a few people that would say, well, it's all about just so they're safe to go home. Or in actual fact, my experience has been that, you know, people do like to share what's going on in their heads, you know. I'm not asking them, but I'm there for the conversation if you want to have it. And I think it's a very important message for people that's what counselling is. It's an opportunity to talk about stuff that you maybe don't feel you can talk to anybody else about. And as a part of the, okay, mate, because it's a little bit, I'd be interested in your thoughts of it. Ultimately your brain wins on, ultimately the anxiety, the flashbacks, the trauma, ultimately your brain wins and will get to the point where you just can't continue to do it. And your message of identifying that and having the skills to, one, accept it might not be the guy next to you or the lady next to you. It could be you. And you need to be in a position to deal with it. It's just such a powerful message and so important for people going into these careers to go, okay, I need to have what Tim now has. Would that be your main message that you need to equip yourself to deal with this?
Yeah, group? I think the whole idea is a choice, and
if you choose to do it,
you're
choosing to do that, but you've actually
you've got to choose to look after. There is a risk there, so if I take it back to a real policing risk mitigation strategy, I'm doing a high risk job. To manage that risk, I need to put some time and effort into my mental health because I know that's one of the things that might impact on me. And it does tie into the work I do now at Phoenix around, so Responder Assist has 7 agencies across Victoria who can now access services that will assist them either as a referral pathway or into a trauma-focused treatment model. But the real message of that is that that's simply part of the plan.
Yes.
So what we're trying to say is that there are options out there. So when you're developing that plan, and I encourage every emergency worker to actually sit down and have a think about what is their plan.
What's my plan?
What's my plan is our new line coming out for Responder Assist. That's the marketing phrase we're going to use. What's my plan? And whether it's Responder Assist or, you know, Blue Hub if you're a policeman or whatever corrections may have available, whatever the resources are that you're going to tap into, it might be your GP and a private clinician. I'm not really fussed. As long as you have a plan about what you're going to do and you've got a group of people around you that you're open with, and that the plan is made when you're well. That's a really important message, that you do the planning when you're well, not when you're in crisis.
And you implement it when you're well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because often, when you sit with people that are really depressed, that they almost, and you've described it, just how low can I go? There's nothing that holds them up.
No.
There's nothing like I go to the gym twice a week, or I go walk the dog twice a week, or some of the simple things that if you do them, in not negotiable things that you just do, I think it stops you from, it just holds you at a higher place if you don't have them.
And I think repeated practiced efforts.
Yeah.
So, I'm really strong on my routine every day that I do. It's changed over the years since the incident, 8 years ago nearly, but really strong on what I do, that I know if I do that every day, if I go to bed at the same time and get up at the same time, I mightn't sleep well, but I'll always have, that'll give me the best chance. Mm. I exercise in the morning. I make sure I have breakfast. Spend time with the wife and kids at night and have dinner with them. The computer goes off when I finish work. There's none of this, like I used to be on 24/7. If I do that, if I engage with my team, if I've, building those relationships around what my team is, if I do that every day and I have a bad day, I just start the next day again. Back from a safe place.
That's a finding yourself, isn't it, in a way, that you weren't able to do. It's a reconnecting with you as different person, but in a positive way.
The challenge is we talk a lot about the external, about making a plan, about who to connect with. There's a lot of work to be done internally around how you manage your thoughts.
Yeah.
Because, my clinician used the analogy, and I use it all the time still, about the junk email. So if I still think about alcohol every day. There's not a day that goes past where you could have a beer or whatever. And for me now, it's just a junk email and I'll dismiss it.
Yeah, that's a great
I don't have to analogy. Think about it. It can just go.
Yeah, into the junk.
Straight into the junk. Yeah. And there's a lot of junk that comes in, believe me. Yeah. But for me, and others will have different strategies, but for me, that works really well. Yeah. And this whole idea of the green to the red and the continuum and where I'm at. And don't get me wrong, I'm still a pain in the ass to live with. I can be difficult and I get angry and don't sleep.
Did you ever think, one last question, did you ever think you would be... When in those dark days where you seriously contemplated taking your own life, did you ever imagine that you could be where you are now?
Depends which era of the day we're talking about, because there were times when I didn't think that there was any way out.
Yes.
Absolutely. The blackest of days where, I lost days where I know I was meant to be out building a deck or something and my wife had come home at the end of the day and I'd done nothing and I don't know what I did for a whole day except for ruminate. But somewhere in that, particularly in that year I was off, I kept a diary during that year at the request of my clinician. And the roller coaster I described before is really strong. There are times during that period where I'm absolutely determined that I'm going to come back and show that you can get through this and you can make a difference and you can change people's lives if you work hard enough and, start to listen to yourself and have a different view of the world and, look at how other people think and try and learn to be better. So I wouldn't say it was ever, any given day, I could be at both of those points.
Right, so you never lost total hope.
No.
On some days you could connect with there is a way out of this, but then other days you couldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think over time that practice of just repeating it over and over again, of doing those things every day, I call everyday attention. So rather than early intervention, which is a phrase we hear a lot, we've got to train people. For me, mental health's about everyday attention. Yeah. You need to do something every day about your mental health, whether it's just that simple exercise plan or whatever it is, something that gets you thinking, I'm doing this because of A, B, or C. If I practice that every day, I know that even if I have those bad days and things aren't going well, I'll get back tomorrow and it'll be the start of another day. So instead of having, where I used to have a month where it'd be no good, it's generally only a few hours now before I can be able to pick myself up again and go.
And reconnect
with myself. And there's days when I just want to go to that place. But, that just happens. Where I just want to feel shit. I don't know why, but that happens.
Well, I guess one last question. I mean, I've already asked you a last question. Yes. But is the trauma aspect lessening as time goes by of the dreams or the, because a lot of people come to me, I don't want to go to sleep because I'm going to get dreams or flashbacks, or which we don't control. Is that lessening as the years have gone?
Certainly the symptoms have lessened. I think certainly, obviously not drinking has helped significantly, but I would say my sleep's still a battle at times. But I think now if I have a flashback or a dream, I've got a different context for it. It is just a flashback or a dream.
Yeah.
I'm not there. It's not real.
It was my life.
That was my life. And, you know, part of doing that work was that these things might happen. Yeah. That so it's really the way I look at it rather than – but having said that, the number and frequency and vividness of them has certainly dissipated over the years. Right. So it is far more controllable now than it was back when I was still working.
Yeah, and that's encouraging for anybody going through what you know, it's going through now, what you've been through is to, okay, as time goes by, they do diminish. And people tell me that, and that gives some hope that I won't always be at the dark spot.
And I guess I'll just reiterate, like, this is my experience, and these are things that work for me in the way that my brain works. I can sort of rattle those things off in a plan that I have, and so on. I'm not saying it'll work for everyone, but I think the universal, undisputed part of all of that is that you do have choices, and a choice is to think about your mental health, and no one else makes that choice except for the individual.
And the neuroscience is now categorical about exercise, socialising, good sleep, diet. You know, there's just now no debate about in any life you need to be doing those things, but in the high risk, high emotional jobs, it's even more important to do. Tim, thank you so much for coming along.
It's been a pleasure.
And sharing your story. And, you know, I think if anybody, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of people out there that will connect with your story enormously, you know, always shoot me an email at bruce@letstalkdifferently.com.au and let me know your response, and I can pass some things on to Tim. Thank you for joining me on this latest episode of Trauma from the Frontline. If you would like to get in touch with me, or if you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to email me at bruce@letstalkdifferently.com.au. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram and YouTube at Trauma from the Frontline. If you are enjoying this series, please make sure you follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And if you find this information valuable, we ask that you rate the show 5 stars. It really helps the show grow and reach a larger audience. Until the next episode, please take care. If this episode has raised any issues for you, free counselling is available through your organisation.